Our next speaker is Bob Higgins and Dennis Sledz, and they're going to talk about modeling and simulation of a gas discharge Leonard prototype.
Have we got the first slide?
We have the first slide.
There we go. I'll be speaking today. Dennis Sledz has returned home because he wasn't feeling well. On Monday, you heard from Dennis Sledz and Dennis Cravens about their DC gas discharge Leonard tube in a CBEC calorimeter that was constructed specifically for it. Today, I'm going to talk about thermal modeling of that system. And it has some aspects in the modeling that I think that could be brought into almost any of your experiments to improve the confidence in the result. So I'm going to begin by reviewing what Dennis Sledz told you about his system. It's a coaxial gas discharge tube about an inch in diameter, and the whole thing's about a foot long, but not all of it is active. It has a small central molybdenum wire, and the active medium is planted on the inside of the coaxial tube. The cathode is the outer conductor of this coaxial tube. Now, this tube is inserted into a copper block in the center of the calorimeter, and around the outside of the copper block are disposed about on four sides, actually five sides of this. It's disposed about 21 CBEC modules. These are high temperature CBEC modules to measure the heat as it exits from the system. So the primary source of the Leonard heat is going to be from the tube that's inserted in the middle, and it will exit to the outside. The issue is that this copper block was designed to spread out the heat, but it has a high thermal mass. Now, in order to operate at somewhat higher temperature, there is provision in here for four cartridge heaters inserted in the block symmetrically around the tube. And this provides a thermal heat bias to the system to heat it up. So the total heat really amounts to coming either from the cartridge heaters, the DC discharge, or any Leonard excess power that happens to be in the system. Now, a common problem that you have in this is that you'd like to have some real-time monitoring or even reporting of what the excess power is. But when you go to make the measurements in your data acquisition system, you measure the input power almost instantaneously, but the output power is sensed as it has come through your calorimeter. And in Dennis's case, the main time constant for this calorimeter is about 2 hours. So it takes a long time before you actually see the heat come out. And if your input is a step, as it was in this particular test, the output is going to gradually rise, and for about 12 hours it's not going to be quite valid. So if you're trying to do something like correlate when the neutrons came out, and he didn't get neutrons, but we heard that reported earlier, to when the excess heat came out, well, you have this high uncertainty as to when exactly the excess heat was produced in this simple method of computing the excess power. So it even gets more confusing when you look at a real experiment. You know, in this case, this is a long, multi-day experiment, and there were lots of changes made here and there in the experiment. And so having that long time constant in his system makes it really difficult to understand, well, what caused what in the system. So what I was providing to their effort was to model the thermal response in the system and try to do a better job of developing an understanding for what happened when. Now, thermal modeling can be done in a lot of ways. You could do it with a solid model, finite element analysis. The problem with that is that the simulation takes forever. It's as good as a design tool for your system, but it's not good as an analysis tool after the fact. It just takes too long. You could also do behavioral modeling where you mathematically extract the impulse response and try to mathematically deconvolve your excess power. But it's really hard to do what ifs. It's very hard to change. You basically have to do the whole analysis over again from the start. What I chose to do is equivalent circuit thermal modeling, and I used the SPICE simulator for that in a transient mode. It's simple to build your model and simple to change, and it's compatible with nonlinearities, and you will have those if you have any convection or radiation in your system. You'll have nonlinearities. And it's easy to incorporate measured data in this, which it turns out to be really important. The SPICE simulators that are available today, even the free ones that you can get off of the internet, they have rich feature sets in terms of graphics and elements and variables, and they simulate quickly. On a typical PC, you can do a simulation in less than 5 seconds. So here are the core thermal modeling analogs that you need to wrap your head around. A voltage is going to correspond to temperature. So when you have a voltage node in your simulation, it's actually a temperature node. Charge corresponds to heat. So charge in coulombs, heat in joules. Current, which is charge flow in amperes, it corresponds to heat flow in watts. So if you look at a thermal resistor, which is just an electrical resistor in the simulation, you have a temperature difference across it and you end up with a heat flow through it in watts. And the resistors can easily be nonlinear in SPICE. Thermal capacitors, you know, if you were to put a current source on a capacitor, you'd get a linear rise in voltage. If you put a power source modeled as a current source into a thermal capacitor, you get a linear rise in temperature. So these are the core components for your thermal modeling in a one-dimensional circuit type of model. Here are a couple of more valuable elements. This little thing right here is an initial condition. You can place that in your simulation because you need to place what the initial temperature is. And it might be room temperature, but you need to place it in there and not presume that it's zero. The other important thing that you find in these SPICE tools is what's known as a piecewise linear source. And that is a text file driven source, whether it's a current source or a voltage source, which becomes a thermal power source or a temperature source or sink. You take a vector out of your data that you acquired in your actual experiment and put it in there, and you drive the source with that. And so you end up driving your simulation with your actual experimental data. And what it does is it's called piecewise linear interpolation because it interpolates between your samples. SPICE does not simulate with uniform time steps. And so because of that, it needs to be able to interpolate between. So let's take a look at modeling the Letts calorimeter. Here is the big thermal time constant component, that big copper block. You can calculate what the thermal capacity of the block is, and it's a number. I mean, it's a big number, and you will use this as the capacitance in your model. But it's simple to get to the starting point. And this absolute number is not going to turn out to be terribly important because the other unknown is the thermal resistance that goes with it for the conduction through the block. Now, when you normally think about this, and he's got CVAC modules on all sides of this block, you might be thinking about the heat flow out to each of those blocks, but you don't really know what any of these thermal resistors are to start with. And in the end, you can combine them all into basically one equivalent thermal resistance, and you only have one unknown instead of all those other unknowns, because you're really not looking for the heat flow distribution as the result of this solution. So then you can think about the delay as the heat passes from the center, where it's being generated by the Lennard tube, to the outside surface, where it will be detected in, as it passes through the seedbed modules. Well, the simple delay is your simple R and C here, and a better model is to split the resistor in half with the same capacitance, and a better still is to distribute it just a little bit more. And very seldom is there any advantage at all to going to split it up any more than this. And so the resulting circuit model, a good circuit model, would look like this for that delay. Now, you've already calculated the capacitance. The unknown here is the resistance. So now modeling the CBEC thermoelectric generator modules that are the detectors for the heat in this system, this module basically has an extremely low thermal resistance going through it of only 0.74 degrees C per watt, and he's got 20 of them in parallel. So it's like 0.037 degrees C per watt. It's almost a short circuit for the heat flowing through there. And it generates a voltage, the module generates a voltage, an electrical output voltage, that is initially presumed to be a linear constant times the heat that is flowing through the module. So here is sort of a first pass model for his system. You have the heat arriving in the center, passing through the delay. You have the CBEC module as being the primary heat path to flow out to the heat sink, where it is presumably at the ambient temperature. In his case, it is not, but it's not important. You have heat leakage to ambient, and you have heat leakage around your CBEC modules to the heat sink. Well, we don't have to simulate the heat sink because he measured the temperature of the heat sink. You can go ahead and create this as a PWL source and put in your actual measured temperature for that sink there. That way you don't have to simulate that part. The ambient temperature, that he measured the ambient temperature. You can use the actual experimental ambient temperature. And of course, you can use PWL sources for what he put into the system. Now, in the case of a null experiment, that would correspond to there not being any unknowns in terms of heat. The unknowns are in terms of your unknown circuit values. So what you basically have here is you have a measured output and a simulated output from a known input. And you're going to put in what you measured, not what you wanted to put in. You put in what you actually measured for the input, and you compare the measured output and the simulated output, and you adjust your parameters, your unknown resistance, your unknown CBEC coefficient. You adjust those until these two match, the simulated and the measured output match. And this process is really tedious. And it's an iterative process. It's called parameter extraction. So here you can see we chose a canonical step input experiment. And it's not a perfect step. This is the actual measured step. And this was what was put into the simulation. The surprising thing that came out of this was that there was more than one heat propagating mode. You see this very long time constant mode of about 2 hours, but there's this very short time constant mode on the front end of it, on the front porch. And where did that come from? After some research, it appears to be an actual second heat propagating mode that is known as a thermal wave or a non-Fourier heat transfer mode. It's an obscure thermal property, characteristic. It's very interesting in itself, but it's sort of beside the point in the modeling. It just complicates the model a little bit. There's no reason why you can't put in two thermal modes in your model. So this is an example of what your SPICE simulator looks like. You have a circuit element window where you have your thermal modeling circuit, and you have your graphic output. You press a button to do a simulation, and blip, it comes back with the latest results. You change the value, and then press the button again. This is a free SPICE simulator. What I use is called Symmetrics, and you can get it for free here. And the transient mode is the mode that you use for simulation. But that's the strength of SPICE. It's a very well-developed old simulator. Now, one of the things that we did to confirm that front porch fast rise time was not a non-linearity in the CVEX was we did a stair step excitation of the system. And in the stair step, if it was non-linearity, you would see it show up as a change in time constant from the small early excitation stair step to this one. But what you see is while there is non-linearity in this, it's not in the time constant. And so this is an actual different propagating mode. Now, I will mention that this is the model and simulated value of after parameter extraction. This is the kind of match that you can expect to get between experimental and simulated results. They overlay. It is a sufficient model to do this in 1D. So here's the final extracted model, and it's a bit more complicated than that simple model because we also are modeling his lid that he puts over the top portion of his calorimeter that is a whole separate section and has its own set of time constants. Now, what you really want to use this model for is now you've got a system where you have known elements in your model. You don't need to adjust anything there. You have a measured output and simulated output, and you have a measured input, but you have an unknown excess heat waveform in there. And what you'd like to do is to be able to adjust the excess heat waveform and extract it like you extracted other parameters so that the simulated output matches the measured output. The problem with this is that this is a problem in deconvolution, which is known as an ill-conditioned problem due to noise. And what happens is the noise in the system can make the answer arbitrary at some frequency range. So as your XP propagates through the long time constant calorimeter, the high frequency components in that waveform are being attenuated, and they're falling down and have no signal to noise. And so that's one of the problems. So you have to be careful to not try and extract the waveform into a region where it's all noise and the answer is arbitrary. So one of the cool ways that we came up with to do this was to not use a manual way to do the extraction, but to use the power of the SPICE simulator itself. What we did was we basically took the output and subtracted the input, and we fed it back in a negative feedback way back to the input. And the negative feedback will cause the simulated and the experimental outputs to match. It drives it to match. And so what happens is this is essentially doing that deconvolution extraction. What I did to test whether or not this actually worked was I injected a mock excess power waveform, and it was a triangle waveform, and you can see that it was recovered there. Okay, so here's some modeling tips that you ought to keep in mind. Don't model anything that you've measured. Only model those things that you don't have data for. Sample 10 times faster than your shortest time constant. Dennis Letts got a surprise in the fact that there was this fast mode in his system, and he really could have used 5 times faster sampling. The thermal capacitors and the metallic conduction resistors are likely going to always be linear. The modeling for the convection and radiation, those are the places where you'd want to insert a nonlinear resistance. Also, as we heard previously mentioned, true endothermic regions in the excess power waveform are exceedingly rare. And so if you're seeing those, there's probably still more you need to add to your model. So modeling, in this case, did turn up some error sources. We found that there was some heater lead wire dissipation that was actually occurring outside the calorimeter. And so it created a calibration error in simple calibration technique. And we found a number of new sources that we needed to model. This included that when you were letting gas into the evacuated tube, which sometimes he did during the course of the experiment, you got Joule-Thomson cooling in there, just like your air conditioner at home. And when you turned on the DC discharge, the gas in there became ionized, but it became heated. And so you were storing heat in the plasma, and when you turned off the DC discharge, that was released. So here's an example of the XP extracted from modeling. You can see, and this is a good place to look at the difference. Notice how flat the extracted excess power waveform is compared to the simply extracted waveform. It develops a lot of confidence because you can go back and adjust the model and get to the take out error sources that you find. So in conclusion, the modeling increases your understanding of the system, and you'll find things that you didn't expect to find in your system when you go through this process. It improves the signal to noise in the extracted XP because you're building in signal to noise from the other experiments that you did to generate the model. The XP waveform extraction gives you a better capability to identify what caused the excess heat or what correlated with it. And these free spice simulators are really valuable as thermal modeling tools. So thanks for listening. We say that we owe a deep debt of gratitude to Industrial Heat for supporting this activity. And while this modeling work was meant to add credibility to the excess heat from that experiment, Industrial Heat has a really high standard for what it takes to be able to claim excess heat, and this did not meet that criteria yet. So here's the criteria.
Very simple question about the evaluation of induction paths within the system, because sometimes the difference in thermal expansion of different material tend to create induction paths that would be changing the behavior of the cell itself. Have you evaluated that?
We didn't see that in Dennis's system as becoming something that would be like some kind of a stepwise change in the response or the behavior of the model. It appeared to be very reproducible. And those are the things that you should watch for in your system, particularly if you see steps and change in behavior, because those normally signal something mechanical happening rather than something normal thermal behavior. And we didn't see that in his system.
Very nice, Bob. I like the approach. I'm going to give you an opportunity to make your modeling more complicated and time-consuming. The claim made, a claim made for complete envelope Seebeck calorimetry is that the response is independent of the source position, which it can't be, because the Seebeck coefficient itself is temperature dependent. So each of those Seebecks is actually operating with a different Seebeck coefficient, and it's often worried me, and people make measurements of it, so it doesn't matter where I put my heat source in the box. But if there are differences in temperature position affecting differences in Seebeck coefficient, then the response will be dependent on that position. Your model can prove to us how little that effect is, and that we don't need to worry about it.
Well, we did end up with some problems with that because, I mean, Dennis had hoped that the big copper block was going to sort of average out changes in position of heat in the Leonard tube. Unfortunately, one of the things that we found and was presented on Monday, where he showed the thermal images that were taken of the tube outside the box, if the discharge was allowed to run while it was being evacuated or gas was being put back in, there were some modes that could be excited where the glow would be right up at the top.
Right.
And when it was up at the top, then most of the heat would be trying to come out of the lid in his calorimeter, and the time constant in that was much different. And so it created an accuracy problem.
Different effect from the one that I was talking about.
But yeah, he has some other things with this that could be improved. Mm. I mean, he would be better off if he measured the temperature of the heat sinks in many places, and then you could break it out and have a separate coefficient for each model if you wanted.
Right, but a nice approach, thanks.
Well, thank you for your presentation.